Hello, and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. We broadcast each week on the premier channel for transformational talk radio on the Internet, Seventh Wave Network, online at seventhwavenetwork.com. Each week, we showcase today's top independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And today, we're going to be talking about a film I feel really touches people's souls, the movie Ray, released in 2004 and now available on DVD. This week is also the first of our shows about my favorite part of making films, creating the story and screenplay. So all of you aspiring screenwriters, listen up. This show is for you. I have as my very special guest, Mr. James L. White, who his story, after decades of struggle as a writer, had his first produced script become Universal Pictures' musical biographical drama of the American legend Ray Charles. The film Ray garnered 6 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, and featured an Academy Award-winning performance from Jamie Foxx. Jimmy White's personal journey had many parallels to Ray Charles' life, and today we'll talk about his story from humble beginnings to what it takes to become one of the most sought-after screenwriters in Hollywood. Well, Jimmy, welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations.
Well, thank you, Randall. Thank you for having me on. Good to be here.
Well, one of the things I want to start off with is how you actually got connected into becoming the screenwriter for the project. Can you tell us a little bit about what that story is?
Well, yeah. How I got connected was really a true blessing. I had written a script called Crabs in a Basket, and it was my first really completed work, which landed me an agent, and this agent sent that script out, and it happened to land on the desk of Stuart Benjamin. And as fortuitous as it might be, Stuart, who normally doesn't read scripts, he told me when it came in, read this, started reading it, and couldn't put it down. So that was which got me my first Hollywood meeting. You know, it's the first time I'd had a meeting in Hollywood as a writer. That was in 1992. And at that meeting, Stuart offered me the opportunity to write the Ray Charles story. And he asked me, would you be available? And I checked my busy unemployment schedule and said, yeah. You know, so I took the job. We stayed in touch over the next 8 years because it took him from 1992 to 2000 to get the money. And then in 2000, he called me February 2000, 5 o'clock. It was a Tuesday.
You remember everything exactly. You got the call.
Yes. And asked me, what was I doing? And I said, I was watching the news. But CNN was watching me, and he said, well, how'd you like to write about an old broken-down piano player? I said, who? He said, Ray Charles, Jimmy, I got the money. So that was how that happened. But, thank God, it was actually my very first Hollywood meeting that I got the job.
No, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the film in its beginnings started with director of the film, Taylor Hackford, some years before, and he had almost 2 decades worth of a journey to get the film made from his beginning of it. And then Stuart Benjamin came in. Now, if anyone who doesn't know Stuart Benjamin, he's not exactly a household name as a producer. Mm-hmm. He did quite a number of movies that people might know about. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know Stuart better than I do.
Stuart and Taylor were business partners. Mm-hmm. And the truth, the way the story really goes is that Ray Charles Jr., and this is going to sound amazing to people, Ray Jr. had run all over town trying to get these different production companies to make a film about his dad, and that was in the 1980s. Nobody wanted to hear it. So he walked through the door, I think it was called New Visions or New Something, that Stuart and Taylor's company was, and he walked in the door there, and he said, yeah. So Stuart was there from the beginning. It wasn't Taylor alone. It was Stuart and Taylor running around from the beginning with this project, trying to get it made. And but Ray Jr. was out there before even they were, trying to get it done. Because when my first meeting with Mr. Charles, he said to me, Ray Charles, I call him Mr. Charles, you know.
Out of respect.
Exactly right. I'm a good Southern boy.
Yeah.
My first meeting with Mr. Charles, I said to him, he said to me, you know why you're here, don't you? And I said, no, sir. He said, well, I'll tell you. My son, Ray Jr. wants to make a film about me. I don't want to do it. I don't need to do it. You know, people know my music, but my son wants to do this, so that's why you're here. So that's who the engine behind all of this is, Ray Charles Jr. Hmm. I mean, in front of all this, I should say.
In front of it.
Yeah.
Spiriting it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well,
he loves his dad,
yeah.
And he wanted the world to know his father.
Yeah. Well, it was. It's a terrific story. You know, any just to honor his father, I guess making the film was his way of saying that this was an important point, and not only his father was not only instrumental in changing American music, but he has become. You know, his legacy goes on through the recording industry in many forms and in many different styles and types of music today.
Oh.
Really started with Ray Charles back in the early 50s.
Yes.
And
yes.
In the film, you show some of that. Now, let's go kind of jump into that
a little bit. Sure.
Now, in the film, there's a lot of different amazing musicians and personalities that come together. One of those is Quincy Jones.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about how that meeting, some of the things that are not in the movie, sort of the behind-the-scenes story about some of Ray Charles and Quincy Jones meeting early on, because I wanted to see more of that.
Yeah, well, it was random. Actually, I wanted to tell a six-hour movie. But, you know, the distributors and the studios wouldn't stand for that, because there was so much there, you know, including his time at the School for the Blind, which was very, very touching, which we had to get rid of. But in terms of his meeting with Quincy, I think Quincy was like 15 and Mr. Charles was like 17 or 18. And they did meet in Seattle, and they did meet, I put it at the Rockin' Chair, because the Rockin' Chair was the center club there, but there were so many clubs there. The jazz scene in Seattle, you know, if you can imagine this, after World War II, Seattle was one of the ports welcoming the soldiers back from not only the Pacific Theater, but some from the Atlantic Theater, but majority of them were coming from the Pacific Theater, from, you know, the battles in Iwo Jima, Okinawa and stuff, and they were all coming to Seattle, and Seattle was probably the most integrated city in America at that time. And it was, you know, wide open, I'm telling you, it was what you might consider wow, you know, because there was clubs, there was jazz, there was drugs, there was women, there was, you know, booze, and so everybody was celebrating the good times. And there were these two young boys who were just eager to learn music, and they were, you know, feeding each other's desire to know music, and that was the thing with these two. These two, Mr. Charles and Quincy Jones, called each other up until probably the day, every day, up until the day Mr. Charles died. Regardless of where they were in the world, they would reach out and talk to each other at least once a day.
Yeah, that's... That friendship lasted a very long time.
Yeah, and it was real. It was real. I'm sorry, they learned. They learned from each other. Like when I'm trying to think of a good famous jazz musician, the Oldest Monk, and things like that would come through town. You know, they had the after hours joints, and these two young kids, you know, 18 and 15, are getting in the after hours joints, listening, sitting there, just learning from these fantastic musicians on, you know, different groups that would come through, how to play this, how to play that, and these jam sessions. Can you imagine the jam sessions those guys were dealing with at that time, with all that music just flowing through? So that was very, very real. I wrote it to try to show it, but, you know, the movie, we only had so much time, so we had to take it out.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to the music part a little bit. I want to go a little bit more into when you started working on, when Benjamin gave you the go-ahead.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first thing that you thought to do? As you approach this as a writer, what was the first steps in actually compiling the material and doing the research toward the screenplay?
Well, the first thing I did was to sit with the family, because the family is key to this. You know, to any biopic, you know, you can do things from public domain if you choose, but as far as I'm concerned, you don't have the human side, and then you're just sort of writing, look at Ray play this song, look at him play that song. You know what I mean? You're moving from one human event to another. But if you have the family involved, such as, you know, Ray Jr., such as Mrs. Robinson, Mr. Charles's wife, then you get a more insightful look into the character. Then the human side comes out. So the first thing I did was sit down with Ray Jr. and talk to him for about a couple hours, because I find in interviewing someone, and I want writers to perk up ears on this. Interviewing someone, the initial interview, the first interview, the first 20 minutes of it is going to be them. You got to sell yourself to this person that they can trust you. And you got to treat that interview and assure the person that whatever is said in that interview will remain, it's almost like a confessional, will remain between you and them. You know, if it's necessary to use in this script, the making of the film, you are clear to them. So the first 20 minutes is that. Then the next hour of the interview, you usually get some pretty good stuff. After the hour, and if you're paying attention, you have to pay attention, people start repeating themselves, then what you need to do is take a break for about 10, 15 minutes and then try to come back, and if you can get something there, maybe you can. Now, the next day, the following day and the days following that, what's going to happen is that the person is then going to say to you the next day, you know, I was thinking about what we talked about, and I was thinking about this, and you get some good stuff, because that first 20 minutes is not going to be that. It's going to be a review. And then after that first 20 to 15 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes, then you move into new territory. But you give them time for review, and then you move into new territory. So most interviews should take no longer. I'm saying all that to say most interviews should take no longer than 2 hours. You know, if you're talking to the person more than 2 hours, you've been talking too much. You have not been listening. Okay?
Right.
Now, well, that was the first step.
Right, that's the first step.
Yeah.
What was your next step after you? I'm sure you talked to not only his family, but
friends. I reached out to other people. And
right,
then,
musicians.
Mm-hmm. And then I read what was there. And then it came the time to try to, you know, once you got all this information that he's done this and he's done that, then comes how do I fashion this story? And in this case, I say thank God for Mrs. Della B. Robinson, Mrs. Ray Charles Robinson, because I was interviewing her, and this is something that as a writer you have to look for these precious moments, I call them, and this was the precious moment where she and I were sitting in her living room, and my youngest daughter was with me, Martina, and she was watching, I think, a Laker game with Ray Jr., and Mrs. Robinson said to me, said, Jimmy, to me, I knew after a while who I was married to, and I knew that he was part of the world, and I had to share him with the world. She said, but I told him that on this side of the door, she pointed to her living room, he belonged to me. On the other side of the door, he belonged to the world. And that's when I got it. I said, God, this is a love story. Yeah, that's when it clicked.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a love story between his relationship with Mrs. Robinson, and also it was a love story with
his mother
and his brother
and his music.
Right.
Yeah, and that was
the music.
Yes, his music is very, very important. In the final scene, when she finally faces him down, I have her say to him, you're going to lose something that you love more than anything, and that's your music, if you don't quit using these drugs.
Yeah, and that was the turning point.
That was the turning point.
In the film.
Yeah, and actually in his life, you know, he saw the threat, you know, and he told me, and he told other people, you know, most people didn't think he was going to do it, that he was going to quit, but he quit, and, you know, I understood that, you know, because, you know, when you, as a junkie, you get there, and when you, so far down that you're looking up and you're seeing down, you can understand that, but, you know, that you go, that's enough, and you quit.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back to that aspect in a little bit, and we'll talk about your journey as well, because you definitely have a parallel to Ray Charles' life and the journey of your story. But I want to stay a little bit on creating the film. Mm-hmm. Now, what was also unique in this respect is Hollywood tends to whitewash biographies, but one of the things that Mr. Charles requested of you is that you make this story factual, make it as true as possible.
Yeah. That was consistently his mantra, if you will, to me. Is tell the truth, Jimmy, just don't make me look too bad. But he would constantly counsel me, tell the truth. When we first started this, my very first meeting with him, you know, he told me, tell the truth, just don't make me look too bad. When I would call him up to, you know, to say, here, I'm thinking about doing this here, how does that sound to you? Does that work for you? And stuff like that. He would go, well, it went this kind of that way, but I can live with that. No, I can't live with that. Turn it this way, or no, that's right on. But he'd say, just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. You know how to do it, you know, but just don't make me look too bad. Right. So he
trusted you to do that.
Oh, thank God. Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's a major plus. But yeah. Also, when the script was complete, I had it translated into Braille, and he read it, and then you obviously waited nervously for his response. Supposedly he came back. I read that he had only two changes on it.
No, he had four.
Four changes.
Ray Jr. called me up and said, "Dad wants to talk to you." So I said, "Are you mad?" He said, "He wants to talk to you." So I said, "All right." So he puts me on the speaker, and Mr. Charles goes, "I read your script," and I said, "Thank you." And he goes, "I got some questions for you." I said, "Yes, sir. What is it?" Because the first, let me say this to you first. The first version, the first version of the script was linear. We started at the childhood with him and George. I started at the childhood with him and George, and went all the way up through his life. You know, going from 5 years old, you know, with a linear story. But the problem with that was we didn't meet Jamie until about page 30. So you got to start. You got to get him on the screen earlier. And so Stuart asked me, "Well, how would you do that?" And I said, "Well, the best way to do that would be start at maybe his mother's funeral. Our first was sitting at the gravesite, and then him leaving the gravesite, walking down the road, and then getting on the bus. Then we just cut it to getting on the bus, and then we go back." But anyway, so his first question was to me, because I opened with a nursery rhyme, which I learned in Kentucky. Which went like, we used to play when we had high gossip. Went last night, night before, 24 robbers at my door. I got up and let him in, hit him in the head with a rolling pin. I was not ready, how I, you know. And so I had George singing that. So Mr. Charles said, "I never heard that nursery rhyme sing it for me." I said, "Well, Mr. Charles, I don't sing." You know, so he goes, sing it for me. I said, "Mr. Charles, seriously, I don't sing." He said, "Sing the damn song." So I sung it. So after I sung the song, he sung it back to me. He said, "Does it go something like that?" I go, "Yeah, that's much better. Yeah, it sounds great." So that was his first note. His second note was that him and Margie never did drugs together, because we, in the first draft of the script, we had Margie and him doing drugs together. And he said, "No, that's not the case." I said, "Okay," so I changed that. And then the third note he had was that Jeff had stolen from him, because in the first I had him seem pretty much played the same, except for the fact that he pulls out these letters showing that Jeff Brown had stolen money from him. So then that was a change. That was a note. And then it was a fourth note, and I can't remember what it is right now, Randall.
Okay, that's fine. Well, that's amazing that you wrote the entire screenplay with all those details, and there were only a handful of changes that he requested.
Yeah.
That shows that you did your homework.
Thank you.
As a writer.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wonderful little story.
Thank you very much.
I want to also just kind of let everyone know who's listening that your life, which had very humble beginnings in Kentucky, and then you, for many years, you learned the task of writing, working, and you went to college in Boston, and you were in the Navy, and so you've had a whole life of experience, and some of those experiences paralleled Mr. Charles' life. So can we talk a little bit about some of what those parallels were like, which actually helped you in the creation of the screenplay?
Sure. As you said, you know, I grew up in Kentucky. I, you know, grew up without a dad. My grandmother raised me. You know, the circumstance of my birth, you know, kind of put me in that situation. My mother was, I guess, a victim of acquaintance rape. And that kind of left me, you know, fatherless and, you know, and sort of like, you know, the rape baby, I guess. So my grandmother loved me, and she took me in and raised me. And, you know, I'm close to my mother today, so I don't want to leave that impression that we aren't close. We're very close, you know, but I grew up with a stepfather, and they always live someplace else, and I live with my grandmother. And my dogs were my friends, you know what I mean? So, you know, Bobo and Ernie and all my dogs were my friends. And I always wanted to be a writer. I read Last of the Mohicans, and I went, "Oh, my God, what? You know, I want to do this. I want to be able to," because what the book did for me is took me from the world that I lived in and put me someplace else. You know, and then, you know, with television and books and movies, I'm sorry, it's like, whoa. But my initial goal was to be a novelist. But after college, you know, due to a lot of, you know, hidden psychological baggage, I guess, in my life, because I have nobody to blame but myself, I got involved in drugs because I didn't grow up in a household seeing stuff like that. I think my grandmother would drink a highball on New Year's Eve and smoke a Lucky Strike. That was her answer. That was a party for her, you know. So I didn't see stuff like that growing up. And, you know, I was away in Boston trying to fit in with the city guys. And me and Mr. Toff talked about that because he was sort of the same way, coming from a small town and stuff like that. You wanted to fit in, you know, as though you were part of the clique. And so I started, started with, I never liked marijuana and stuff like that. I tried it and I thought it was boring. And I started with heroin and then cocaine, and then heroin and cocaine together. And I started shooting it. I did that for several years. Of course, I kept good jobs. I was a city health inspector, different jobs and things like that. But I was destroying myself. I can't now that I'm older, now that I look back on it, the things I'm doing now I could have done years ago. But I was, bogged down in, whatever circumstances that, life had dealt me, and I took these drugs as a way of coping, which was stupid.
And so, just like in the film with Ray Charles, he decides that that's it, and he just cold turkey quits.
You did
the same thing.
Yeah, I did. I moved from Boston to California. I didn't know anybody out here, so I came out here and I couldn't get drugs. So I went cold turkey. And went through all the withdrawal symptoms and on my own. I wasn't in a clinic or anything. I just went on my own and went through it. And it was, I'm glad I did. I don't miss it. You know, it's not a day in my life that I go, boy, I sure wouldn't mind that one more time. You know, thank God I'm out of that. But yeah, I did. I went cold turkey on heroin and cocaine.
So when you moved to California and you decided, since you thought you were going to be a novelist, and what was the thing that changed you and started getting you interested in actually screenwriting? What did you study?
It was a pure accident because I wanted to go to France to write novels, and my grandmother said no. Because if something, my grandmother's theory was I had to be in bus ride distance for her. She wasn't going to get on a plane, so I wasn't. And she couldn't get to France, so she said, no, I couldn't go to France. And I didn't like New York, so I came to L.A. And then I thought if I went to New York, heroin would probably be there, and it would be easy to find. So I came to Los Angeles, I was working selling cars, and I had...
And you had a family at that time?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I was just about to meet my girlfriend, who became my wife, and she plays such a role. She doesn't do anything. She doesn't drink. She doesn't smoke. I think she breathes air and drinks water. That's it, So, thank God she doesn't, because two junkies would have been horrible. But she and I just met, and then I met a guy in the building, a character actor named Lincoln Kilpatrick. And Lincoln said he was putting together a group of writers and stuff like that. And I said, well, I got stuff. And he goes, okay, well, come show up at my office and stuff over on Beverly Boulevard in West Hollywood. So I show up, and there I meet a guy named Joe Cardone. And I want to repeat that name, Joseph Cardone. He just had a film out called The Covenant. Please go see it, because that's my friend. And Joe looked at my stuff, because it was, I was trying to write a novel, and he said, man, you have a great imagination, but you don't know crap about structure. He said, if you want, I'll teach you structure. And I said, fine. But I thought he was teaching me structure on novels, but he was taught me screenplay structure. And so Joe's the one that got me involved in screenwriting. And Joe lived in Studio City. We were in West Hollywood, and then we got married, and I sobered up. I promised Liz that I was going to, it's my wife's name, Elizabeth, and we call her Liz. I promised her that I was going to sober up, and I did. I kept my word. And I was off of heroin, but I was messing with cocaine, but I promised her I was done, And we got married and everything, and we have a son and everything. So, but Joe lived in Studio City, so I would go over the hill to Joe, and Joe would go, okay, here's your scene. what's the action of the scene? You know, why is this guy talking? Why is she talking? Why do you start the scene here? Can you start it there? And he took me through what I call the Joe Gordo boot camp of screenwriting. And that, Randall, lasted about 3 or 4 years.
So he mentored you and taught you everything that he knew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's another piece of advice to screenwriters, is get someone to mentor you.
Yeah, only one person. Don't go two, three people. Right. Get one person who you trust. You don't need somebody who's trying to hurt your feelings, who's mean-spirited. You need somebody who really cares and really likes what you're doing. And Joe did that for me. I'm sorry, he would go through the scenes. What's the action of the scene? And this is back when we had rented an electric typewriter. We were Liz and I, and it was like $5 a week, and that was a big deal, because it had, you could press a button and it did the whiteout.
It would correct it, right.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember those days.
But the thing about that, though, was when I was writing, you know, if I had to change the scene, then I had to repaginate all the pages and, you know, white out the numbers and stuff like that. So I drive over to Joe's, and I go back, and I'd be so pissed going back over the hill, because there was nothing wrong with that scene. But I would change it anyway, and I rewrite it, and I go back over. And this is why he's working on his own work. He would do this. He would set off a block of time, and then he would look at my work and go through it. So I give all the credit to where I am now, to Joe Cardone, because for what he did now, Randall, I can look at a scene and go, well, okay, fine, this shouldn't be here, that should be there, boom, 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 in no time flat, because Joe taught me that.
So there you were, starting to learn from him, and you had a little corner of, now your wife, was she a veterinarian?
She teaches veterinary.
She teaches veterinarian, okay.
Yeah, she teaches veterinary nursing at Pierce College,
okay,
in Woodland Hills. And then we were living over top of an animal hospital. You know, it was a little nice. I loved the place because it was where, you know, I did this work, you know, because we moved from West Hollywood to Santa Monica because Jimmy, our son, was born. And we moved to a little small two-bedroom apartment above this animal hospital on Wilshire. And we were living there. And it's funny because the door to our place come up some stairs, and then the door to the animal hospital was right there on the left. And sometimes people would start up the stairs. I'm sitting there working with their cat and dog. Hello, hello, meow, boo, boo. You know, and I'm like, this is not the animal hospital. Oh, okay.
So the time you're sitting working away on this, and then you got to know lots of other. Did Joe introduce you to other people who?
Joe
were
helped me get my first agent.
Okay, he helped you get your agent.
Yeah, he
helped
me get my first agent, and he worked hard to do that. You know, to get somebody. I think he threatened the guy to leave him if he didn't sign me. I don't know, but you know, I always felt that. But Joe helped me to get my first agent. He showed my work around and stuff like that when he was in shape, you know, I had to wait till he was in shape. That's he helped me get Crabs in the Basket, you know, which I hope to get made into shape, which is the film, the script that Stuart read, you know.
So that you wrote a really good, solid script, and that was your calling card and your agent, and then that's you connected up and you got the work on the way from there. So there you go. There's your story. I just wanted to give the listeners an idea of how you started and how long it took you and all the life experiences that you went through to be able to get to the point that you reached in having your first screenplay produced. You see, that's what writers have to understand. It's the life experience that they write about that they can communicate clearly in the movie and accurately and emotionally. So one of the pieces of advice that I always hear from screenwriters and from people who teach screenwriting is write what you know.
And a good learning advice, I would tell writers to do a couple things. Wherever you live, get on a bus, mass transit, whatever, and just ride and listen to people talk. That gives you dialogue. Go into a bar, order a cranberry and soda, and sit there and listen to people talk. Watch what they do. You know, if you're talking too much, you can't be a writer. You've got to listen, and that's where your characters come from, is doing a bunch of listening. My first job in Hollywood, the first official job which got me into a guild, Sidney Poitier hired me as a writer. And he asked me, he said, where have you been? And I said to him, I couldn't think of anything else. I said, doing research. He thought that was very funny. You know, so But that's what you have to do. You have to research life, and you have to, you know, draw upon your experiences, you know, by interacting with people. Don't get yourself into a group and a clique and try to write from what you see on TV or what you see in a movie. Write from what you see in life.
So let's go back to some of the aspects of the movie that that you were putting together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you created the idea of telling the film in a sort of stream of consciousness manner to kind of jump back and forth in time,
mm-hmm.
how did you decide on what to put where in terms of the structure of the story?
Okay, well, a lot of that had to do with getting Jamie, as I said a few minutes ago, getting Jamie on the screen, you know, because we have an actor, we have a star, and we got to get him on the screen, so, you know, we had to start with that. Then, when I did that, then it became a linear tale somewhat in the backstory of George, the music, and things like that, to tell it linear, in a linear way, but I knew at a certain point the flashbacks had to end, and I wanted them to end around page 35. Memory serves me correct, I think we did our last one about 37-38, page 37-38, was our last flashback until the end, where the conclusion is that he comes and he resolves things about feeling the guilt about George's death and being able to forgive himself when he's going through withdrawal. You know, but that was the way I structured it to tell you two parallel stories at once.
So you had, now, the other character in the film, besides mm-hmm. the people, is the music itself.
Right. Thank you.
Right.
I realized the music was a character.
Right. The music is a character.
Yes.
So let's explore that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have performances that are there, and you also have songs that are strictly on the soundtrack that mm-hmm. aren't performed in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So how were those choices made?
The soundtrack I had nothing to do with, but the songs in the film, I had to put them in because I turned in my first draft. I said, "Where's the music?" I said, "Oh, you want me to do that?" He said, "Yeah." So I went back because you know there's what I warned writers also ahead of time. There's what is called a producer's pass, and you know that's where you do a draft and the producer takes a look at it and you don't get paid for that. And you know the thing I would caution you is the number of producer passes you allow, and that's going to depend, because I did a movie once, the company will remain unnamed, where they had a development person that put me through, and I was new, like my second or third job, and I did like 15 producer passes, which is way beyond what you're supposed to do. But I was new and I was eager, and this person took advantage of me. Don't let that happen to you. 3, 4, 5 is really pushing it, producer pass. But Stuart had looked at a producer pass and said, "Where's the music?" And I said, "Oops." You know, so I went back, you know, and I was familiar with Mr. Charles's music, but I went through all the music, and then I put in music, and then, of course, when I was working with Taylor as the director, he and I together would go through and decide, okay, this song works here, this song works there. But I have to say, when the scene where Nighttime is the Right Time starts playing, where Mr. Charles and Marjorie in the bathroom, and she's talking about how much she loves his music, and when he spills the dope and everything. That actually, I was sitting here writing about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had his songs on the loop in my computer, you know, and I'm listening to his music, and that song actually came up just as I was finishing that scene, and it just went right into the next scene.
So that was just a happy accident.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about one moment in the movie that just, because we discussed this previously,
mm-hmm.
and when he came, the first film that was, he had a hit before, he had a breakthrough hit, his first film,
mm-hmm.
I mean, his first song,
mm-hmm.
but the song that really put him on the map was What I'd Say. And you, mm-hmm. in the movie, now, he had 20 minutes more to play
mm-hmm.
in the gig, and he had to improvise something.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you showed in the film is exactly the way it happened.
Yes, exactly. That's the way it happened. That's real. You know, that was the most.
So he just made it up on the spot.
Yeah, he did. He did. You know, they played every song in the book, and that's what it's called, the book, you know, everything that they had. And the guy was giving Jeff a hard time about, you know, come on, you know, you guys, you're not going to come in here and shortchange me like that. You know, you're not going to be leaving early. You know, play, you know, I need another song. So Jeff went up and told Mr. Charles, and, you know, they thought they were going to start early. He said, no, just follow me. Everybody follow me. And he came up with what I said. You know, and it was like, whoa. And then there was the thing of Ahmed and Jerry didn't know how to deal with this song because, one, it was an amazing song, but, two, it was very risque. You know, how are you going to get this out here? And it's very long. So that's when, you know, Tom Dowd, who I didn't get to talk to, who I wanted to talk to, Tom Dowd cut it into A and B.
Now, that's one of the things you just mentioned was that that point in the development of music when it was going from the sort of what I heard in the film was sort of the first hints of rock and roll a little mm-hmm. bit in there mm-hmm. with the soul. And mm-hmm. and so Ray Charles was the first songwriter, musician to start to have his music banned
right.
by long before the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
this was happening back in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about that period.
The late 50s. Early 60s, late 50s. There was a lot of protests, and a lot of people don't realize among the black community, he was like Satan himself. You know, because, you know, he took the rhythms, and he took the beats, and he took the melodies that came out of the gospel, kicked it up a bit, and put in, you know, secular words. And the blacks, that was sacrilegious. God himself was going to be angry at us. You know what I mean? So that just really got him not only banned, but protests. Black people were protesting him.
Radio stations were banning his
yeah,
music.
Yeah, they were
yeah, everything.
Playing his music and stuff like that. There was one radio station, and then I would love to see a movie done on WLAC, Nashville, Tennessee, which played throughout the South. And WLAC at 6 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night was all redneck, good old boy country music and farm news and stuff like that. But at 10 o'clock at night, from 10 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning, and you could hear throughout the South, they played nothing but black music. They played Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, you name it, Ray Charles, they played it. And this station, I forgot when they went off the air, they have a website, but WLAC.com or something like that. But they played this music, and they kept people like Ray Charles and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Water from starving, and they got them out there where people knew them. Now, what's weird about this station, and a lot of people didn't know it because it was John R., Gene Nobles, and people like that, they were all white guys. Every last one of them were white guys. There was only one guy who sounded white, and he was the black guy. His name was David White, but he did the news, and he sounded white. The other guys sounded like black guys. They were all white.
Then you had white guys who sounded black like
yeah,
Elvis.
Exactly. That was just the way they talked. They weren't pretending, you know what I mean? You know, because, you know, how you get somebody who's trying to pretend. But these guys weren't pretending. This was just their diction, the way they spoke. And they were selling these records over the air, you know, and they kept the music alive, because if it hadn't been for those guys, Ray Charles and all of them would have gone under. Because me and Mr. Charles talked about Gene Nobles. Oh, he said, oh, he's the man, Jimmy. He's the king. You know, and he went into great detail about WLAC, Nashville, Tennessee.
And those records were called, they actually had a term called race records.
Race music. Yeah. Race records. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But right. for Ray Charles, he saw past the categories and simply played what he felt.
Yes. Mr. Charles, there was a scene in that we had from when he was in the School for the Blind. And at the School for the Blind, it was segregated. You know, the white blind kids lived on one side of the school, and the black blind kids lived on another side of the school. And he said it puzzled him, and he asked the question, what difference does it make? We're all blind. How do we know?
So, that's funny.
So we had that in the movie, but we couldn't keep it in the script because of time. But yeah, I don't think he saw race as much. He looked at character of the person, and he listened to you very carefully, you know, and he would analyze based on what your words and what he heard, you know, coming out of you.
Right. I want to go a little bit into the story of his mother. Now, mm-hmm. you start the film with a memory that she's doing laundry now. That's something similar, another parallel to your life,
yes.
where your family members were doing laundry. And so that
yes.
almost, that sort of comes out of your childhood, but it's very similar to
yes.
some of Ray Charles's
mm-hmm.
early life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my grandmother took in laundry and stuff like that. And to me, that was a memory of the backyard, hanging out the sheets, you know, and stuff. And Mr. Charles's mother took in laundry, you know, as well. And she, my grandmother took in laundry, and she did it on her own. But Mrs. Charles took in laundry, and she was subcontracting for someone else. You know, she was subcontracting out for someone else. I gave the woman the name of Eula, but Mrs. Charles was subcontracting. But Mama, my grandmother, I called her Mama. She worked, and she worked and did domestic work for about two or three different families, and then did laundry. So I would, you know, empty the water, you know, because we didn't have in that part of Kentucky where I grew up, in the black section, the color section, as they called it, in the late 60s and 70s, they called it the color section. You know, they didn't put in plumbing in that part of town until, I want to say, 74, 75. When my grandmother had her first inside bathroom, you know, but I would heat the water on the stove for her, and you know, carry the water. And I as a kid, I wanted to get all these Muscle Man books and stuff. My grandmother would say, "Don't worry, you're gonna have muscles. Don't worry about that." You know, so that I didn't know that carrying water and all that stuff was actually physical workout. You know,
right? But in the film. Ray Charles's mother actually is sort of the voice of his conscience.
Yes.
She's the one who tells him that don't, you know, not to be a cripple. You know, you're blind, not dumb. You lost your sight, but
that
you haven't lost your mind.
Yeah, that was her phrase to him. She mm-hmm. said that to him when he started going blind. She said that to him over and over again. You're not stupid. You're not going crazy. You're just going blind. So use your mind.
And in the film, you infer that it was also the trauma of his brother's drowning, his
mm-hmm.
death.
Well, he felt guilty about that.
Yeah.
He felt very, very guilty about that. Because I'll say this now, and I don't think I'm divulging anything, because what had really happened, and I played it in a way to keep my bond with Mr. Charles, that I didn't want to make him look bad, because what had happened is that Mr. Charles is actually, they had had a penny, a old-fashioned penny, I guess. It was a big, large penny. I guess pennies back in those days were pretty huge. And he had flipped it, and he'd gone into the water. George was trying to get it out, and George fell in. And he felt trauma that he had caused that. That he hadn't, had he not flipped that penny, that he wouldn't, George would be alive. Hmm. But I couldn't, you know, I didn't know how it would play with the audience, you know, seeing that our hero was actually maybe guilty of something like that.
So you just had to be like he
accidentally
fell
George,
in.
Yeah, they were playing, and George just tripped and mm-hmm. hit his head.
Well, and one of the things that after Taylor Hackford played that scene for Ray Charles,
mm-hmm.
and when he heard when he heard how the scene went, as far as the way his mother spoke to him in the film,
mm-hmm.
or spoke to the audience as a narrator, he said, that's exactly it. That's mm-hmm. exactly
yeah.
the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing that you got that close to reality with your screenplay. You definitely a close relationship with Mr. Charles.
Yeah, it was. Thank God. You know, thank God. Because that was one of the things that, out of this, because you know you and I spoke, I give Mr. Charles all the credit, because he could have very easily, after our first meeting, because I was totally unknown. I was, you know, I was a guy who was doing work in development, you know, but you know, I hadn't anything produced. I'd written a lot of development scripts, and that's, you know, it pays well. It's good work if you can get it, but you know, you don't get anything out of it. So he could have very easily, after my first meeting, picked up the phone, called Stuart, and said, I don't know what you're trying to do here. We've been trying to get this film made for a lot of years. Who's this guy you just sent in here? You know, and they would have, I'd been fired off the project without any hesitation, because Ray Charles finally he embraced me. He became my champion, and he became, you know, a guy. He told me, he said, Jimmy, if they give you any, I don't know if I can use the word.
You gave me any grief.
Give you any grief. tell him Ray Charles said to do it, and, you know, he says, and tell him I'm mad. You know, you use God in the other word. But I'm not mad, though, but you just do that. Don't worry about anything. Just go ahead and say, I said, if they call me, I'll say, yes, I told him to do that. So, but I never did use his name like that, but he gave me permission to do that.
Yeah. So he opened up to you because also he knew that, you know, your circumstances of your earlier life, and he said he would say things like that. You've been there, you know, so you can write about that.
Yeah, he did. But when he really opened up to me was when he asked me where I was from, you know, because, you know, when I first went into the interview and after he told me about it, I was there because of Ray Jr., I said, well, you know, I'm trying to be this make an impression on Ray Charles. I said, well, you know, Mr. Charles, I was thinking about doing this and that and everything. I was thinking about making this a love story. What do you think? And he said very coldly, I don't know. You're the writer. You tell me. You know, it's just like, oh, shoot. I mean, shoot. So, I'm yelling up from this deep hole that I just dug, and he reached down into the hole, and he said to me, he said, where are you from? And I said, Kentucky. And he goes, where? Lexington, Louisville. I said, no, sir, I'm from a little small town, Mount Sterling, Kentucky. And he goes, oh, you're a country boy. I said, yeah. And from there, man, he just opened up. And we begin to bond from there. And then, as you say, later on, because I told him I was, you know, ex-junkie, and we talked about that and everything like that. So we really bonded, you know, and we were able to talk to each other, I felt, in a very open manner, which helped me to craft the screenplay.
What now that the film is on DVD and it's been out for some time, and it was again nominated for Best Picture, and all of this response that has happened because of it, because of, and then subsequently, just to let the audience know, Ray Charles did see the movie when it was completed.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He got to see it in 2000. When was it released? October 2004. Mm-hmm. We showed it to him. Taylor and Stewart showed it to him February 2004. And he didn't call me, so I assumed he was happy with it.
That's good. What do you think, now that the film has been out, do you feel that the public recognition of Ray Charles is people appreciate him more and his music?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I am so glad Ray Jr. did this for his dad. I'm so glad that the public has gotten to see this man. You know, there's so much more I would like to tell, you know, like part two of Ray's early years or something, but I just think he's a fantastic person, so I agree with you that I think people now are embracing his music and know a lot more about the man, you know.
Well, one of the things that happened, and you talk about this a little bit in that period that people were banning his music, is that the state of Georgia actually, in 1979, they issued a formal apology to him because they had banned his music in the state
from playing.
Okay, they banned him from playing in the state.
Yeah, because he reneged on a contract because segregation was so heavy, you know, in the South. I don't know why they did this, but they were blacks. We had to go to the balcony. I loved that in the theaters, you know. The balcony was great. You had a great view. You could see the movie from the right distance and stuff. But anyways, but they would put us up in the balcony. And Mr. Charles said, no, that's enough. It didn't exactly happen the way we depicted in the film, but it did happen that he said no.
But it was also in the 1960s that Ray Charles became an activist for civil rights.
Yes, and we had that in, and we had to take it out because he really liked Martin Luther King. He really liked what he was doing, what he was saying. But he told Mr. King, you know, we had it in where he played a concert because he said to him, you know, I'm blind. I can't see stuff being thrown at me, so I can't march with you and stuff like that because I just, you know, everybody would be worried about my well-being. But what I can do is I can raise money. And he spent a great deal of time doing free concerts and things like that. to raise money for, you know, to bail out the civil rights workers and the freedom riders and things like that. He was very involved.
Right, and he was the very first artist to refuse to play in segregated clubs.
Very first time. Very first one.
Right. Yeah. And that's what got Georgia to ban him for life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was, and in the film, there's a scene where he's not, he sort of becomes aware of that this is happening, in the scene where there's a whole crowd around him,
mm-hmm.
and you have
mm-hmm.
that one man that's trying to get his attention,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and now that the actor that you cast in that role, he sort of looks a little like Malcolm X. And I thought, are we trying to say something here?
No, that was an accident.
That was an accident. Okay. So for anybody who sees the film and sees that movie,
yeah, that was
an accident.
I saw that too. You and I was when we were shooting it, because I was on the set every day when we were shooting. I looked at this guy and I went, oh my, because that's the first time I seen him. You know, because that was, you know, one of those minor roles. I was in on the casting of all the major roles, but it was a minor role and stuff like that. And it was a local guy that they picked. I went, oh my god, he looks like Malcolm X. You know, but it worked, but it was, I didn't intend it. I don't know, maybe Taylor, if you talk to Taylor, he might say, you know, that, oh yeah, this is what he was going for, so I can't speak for him.
It was subliminal.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to just, we're coming close to the end here, mm-hmm. another several minutes, but
mm-hmm.
The aspect of now, keeping in line with what we were just talking about, segregation, I want to mm-hmm. kind of bring that out to Hollywood nowadays. Now, there's a mm-hmm. lot of movies that are being made that still, unfortunately, portray African Americans in a very dismal light.
Oh, God, yes.
And one of the things that you're focused on as a writer is changing that in the larger public perception.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but there's also a stigma in Hollywood today that they don't think that black movies aren't going to be successful unless they mm-hmm. sort of have a different, you know, a character that, you know, that's maybe more hip or
mm-hmm.
more, quote, black or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it, what do you perceive being a black writer, a successful black screenwriter in Hollywood? What do you see as some possible moves towards changing that stereotype in Hollywood?
Well, just keep coming at them, you know, because the, you know, I feel a tremendous responsibility, and I said this at screening of Ray at the Writers Guild. I feel the onus is on me, you know, and the onus is on black writers. These are our stories. These are human stories, and we got to tell them in a human way, because I didn't want, when I wrote Ray, it wasn't about, you know, we touched on segregation and what happened in the civil rights movement, but I don't want it to be a closed shop, and by that I mean, if I'm white, I'm not going to pay $10, $11 to go sit in the dark for you to tell me what a jerk I am. I'm just not going to do it. You know, and if I'm black, which I am, I'm not going to pay $10, $11 for you to go sit in the theater for you to tell me that my life is a cartoon. You know, I'm not going to do that either. So my job, I feel, is to write human stories. If the character is black, I want you to be able to sit in that theater and pay you $11 or buy the DVD and sit in your home and look at it and go, I can understand that, because it's done from a human point of view. And that's my job. You know, it's not your job as a white audience or as a white viewer to go, you know, I have to get this. You know, I can't write something in code that only if you have the black secret decoder ring you can decipher. You know, I have to write it in a way that a human can understand it. You know, because our human condition is our human condition. The thing that me is that we all express it different because of culture differences. You know, like I just came back from home. I went home to see my mom in Kentucky, and I'm sitting there listening to my friends talk, and I'm thinking, there's people that could sit here and hear these guys talk and wouldn't know what the hell they're saying. We go, what? You know what I mean? But that's the human, but if I knew what they were saying, so my job is actually to translate those human words into a format that everybody can understand what they're saying. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That makes a heck of a lot of sense. Well, Jimmy, I really appreciate your time mm-hmm. being on the program today.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
And I hope to see you again. see you again on the show at some point with your next film. Yeah, you're working
Robert
on
Johnson.
A story of Robert Johnson for HBO right now. That's terrific. Anybody
mm-hmm.
doesn't know who Robert Johnson is, why don't you just tell everyone who Robert Johnson is?
He's Father of the Blues.
Father of the Blues.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
so. Well, Jimmy, thanks so much.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate your time. It's been a real pleasure.
Mine. Thank you, Randall.
Okay. Well, take care.
All right.
Well, that's a wrap for our show for this week. Join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. I'd like to thank our engineers, Ruben Colomb and Ryan Treacher, who helped put the show together, and especially to Tom Kirsch and the rest of the Catfish Groove Farm Band, don't you love that name, Catfish Groove Farm, for our theme music. You can hear more of their really cool tunes at catfishgroovefarm.com. And, of course, you can find out more on the Internet about Spirit of Film Conversations and the movies we talk about each week by going to my website at spiritoffilm.net. And please tell your friends where to find our program right here on SeventhWaveNetwork.com. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Abaro for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.